Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, the assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in Environmental Studies. Today, I'm speaking with Jeff D. Colgan, Richard Holbrook Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science and Director of the Climate Solutions Lab at the Watson Institute for Public and International Affairs at Brown University. His new book, Partial Hegemony, Oil Politics and International Order, from Oxford University Press, offers a new framework for considering the nature and change of international order. Jeff examines international relations through the prism of oil politics, with a particular focus on the oil crisis of 1973. Partial Hegemony is a vital book for understanding the broader political and historical context informing contemporary international order and the challenge of addressing climate change. Hi, Jeff. It's great to have you on the New Books Network.
Hi, Caleb. Thanks so much for having me on.
Of course. So as standard with New Books Network interviews, the first question I'd like to ask, if you can just tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book.
Sure thing. Yeah, I have been a political scientist now for, I guess, 12 years since PhD. And I wrote my first book based on my dissertation called Petroaggression, When Oil Causes War. So I've been obsessed with oil and energy politics for a very long time now. And in this book, I really wanted to take what I had learned, not only with my first book, but in all the research since then, about the last century's worth of oil politics and oil history, and learn from it, reflect based on that empirical history. Like, what could it tell us about IR more generally? Theoretically, what does this tell us about international order and how it works? And I grew kind of really dissatisfied with some of our existing kind of models for how international order works. So in the book, I say, look, the move here is to go from the particular, meaning oil politics, to the abstract, meaning the IR theory, and then back again to some other particular subject matters like climate change or peacekeeping or nuclear politics, lots of different things that we can apply that theory to. So that's basically how I got there.
What are some of the standard IR theory models, and what are the issues with these standard models?
Yeah, so if you think about international order as a set of principles, rules, and institutions about how states and other actors interact with each other. So these are sort of loosely speaking rules of how we get along. Then the kind of standard, IR 101 model, crudely put, is to say, look, when does the order change? It changes when there's a big war like World War II. And out of that war, you get a winner who we call the hegemon, like the United States in 1945, who gets to then sort of set the rules for the post-war era. And that lasts until the next big war. And that's basically how history moves. And that's, of course, I'm very crudely characterizing the theory, but that's basically the gist of IR theory. And I got thinking a lot about how that's just too simple. It kind of washes out so much of what's interesting about international politics, because the international order we're living in today, in 2022, is very different than the one that existed in 1946, say. And a lot of things have happened because there's kind of constantly, when we think about international order, some parts of it that are changing and other parts of it that are not changing, that are continuous over time. And so rather than treat it as one big thing, international order that is, you know, the liberal order that is or is not changing, in fact, we should be disaggregating and starting to think about it in different ways. And that, I think, is also born out of our times on some level, because we had in 2016 the election of Donald Trump and the Brexit votes and a bunch of other things that got people thinking hard about, you know, is the liberal order coming to an end, so to speak? And of course, the pages of journals like Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy, et cetera, are just filled with people on both sides of this saying, you know, yes or no, and for these reasons. And to me, I think that debate is fundamentally intractable if we think about international order as just one thing, right? That it's not, you know, in reality, it's actually made up of a whole lot of different parts that I call subsystems. So that's the gist of the book.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about this idea that you put forward that you call subsystems theory, and how subsystems theory differs from some of these other ideas that you've already talked about a little bit, but some of these other notions of how international relations functions?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think about many theories of international order, like, say, John Eikenberry's famous one, or John Mearsheimer just wrote a book on international order, both of them think about international order at the systemic level, right? That it's like sort of one big overarching umbrella of things. And that's a, you know, conventional way of thinking about it. And there's some utility to doing that. But another way that IR scholars have thought about it is, especially in the 80s, there was this idea of regime theory, where a bunch of people like Bob Cohen and Steve Krasner and others, Susan Strange, said, you know, we should be thinking about international order in terms of issue areas, right? And so issue areas are things like trade or finance or oil. Those are all, you know, issue areas. And then we can think about, you know, how the dynamics of each of those issue areas. And so what I argue in this book is that regime theorists were on the right track, but they didn't go far enough, that they need to disaggregate one more level down, because within those issue areas, like say oil, there are specific subsystems that revolve around kind of key questions of governance. And I'll give you an example in just a sec, but in oil, there are two different issue areas. And so you could have change in one of them and not change in the other. And that turns out to be really important, because if you're arguing at the issue area level of like, has change happened or not, it's intractable. You can't get anywhere, because it's both yes and no at the same time. And so I'm saying, look, let's get down to the level of where these governing questions really happen. And in oil, I think the two that matter are, on one hand, an oil production subsystem, which is how much oil should we produce and where do we produce it, right? That's the basic question at the heart of that. And that's been a question for a long time. That's the question that OPEC tries to answer on a sort of weekly basis, right? And lots of other actors, you know, Exxon is in on it, and the fracking industry, and Russia, and all these other players, they're all part of a subsystem, a whole series of actors that are orbiting around that central question of how much oil should we produce and where to produce it, right? But there is also in oil a second big question that often goes kind of unnoticed until something happens, which is the oil security subsystem. And that the core question there is, how should the oil fields of the world be distributed politically around the world, right? And or you know, another way of putting that is, who should have sovereignty? Who should have jurisdiction over each oil field? And often that's quite stable until something like 1990, Iraq invades Kuwait and starts to move towards Saudi Arabia and wants to be an you know, to seize a lot of oil fields and potentially be a quasi-monopolist in the world oil market, because they would have control over so much, which the US and the UK thought about for all of about 48 hours and decided this is no good, right? George Bush comes to the public and says, this will not stand. And then he puts together an international coalition and pushes Iraq back and you know, liberates Kuwait, if we want to call it that. And so the point here is that this subsystem, this oil security subsystem, really matters a lot because, and great powers are willing to go to war over it because it potentially threatens the whole market structure of the world market for oil, right? And the market for oil is quite integrated globally. It turns out to be very cheap to transport oil around the world. And so the price matters everywhere. Price effects in one country is going to translate, it's going to ripple around the whole world. And so having access to a stable supply of oil is vitally important for both the economy and the military of all modern nations. And so having access to oil really matters. And that means great powers are willing to go to war for it. And so this oil security subsystem also turns out to be functionally really important. And just to finish the thought, and then I really will draw a moment of breath, but what we see, if you look back over the last century or so, the really big shift, if you want to think about it, is in the 1970s, that pivotal decade where one of these subsystems, the oil production one, changes dramatically, where OPEC comes to its day. We get the big oil crisis in 1973. We get a really transformational moment where the oil producers like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iraq, they nationalize their oil industry. They jack up the price of oil by a factor of four. They just have a huge shift. And that has massive consequences politically and economically that reverberate around the globe for years to come. But on the other subsystem, the oil security subsystem, you actually have much less change. In fact, you could call it continuity because you have these kind of oil for security arrangements between the United States and many of the same actors, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the other Persian Gulf monarchies. So you get, you know, continuity there that you would be blind to if you just think about oil as one issue area. It's only when you see it as two different subsystems that you can see that there's change in one and not in the other.
Yeah, I want to, you know, to ask you more about this pivotal decade in oil politics. But I think before jumping into that, you know, you provide a great sort of history of 20th century oil politics and sort of beginning, you begin that history with the British Navy's transfer from coal to oil. So I was wondering if you could just talk about the role of oil and just the process of colonial reach and imperialism and how that even that prehistory set the stage for what would happen 60 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the early part of the 20th century, around, you know, 1910, 11, 12, 13, the British figure out, the British Navy figures out that the you know, physical properties of oil are just so much better than coal that they have to start fueling their Navy because of it. And the world starts to shift its whole transportation system and its military system because it's, you know, soon it's tanks and jet fighters and all the rest that are all powered by oil, that the whole global modern transportation system is based off of oil. And that's still the case now, even though, you know, gradually we're starting to think about electric vehicles. But for the last 100+ years, it's been essential. In this time, the first half of the 20th century, empires are not dead. They are, in fact, the dominant form of political organization on the planet, right? This is a hugely, you know, imperial period. And the two subsystems that I talked about oil production and oil security, in this period, they're sort of overlapping and they go hand in hand because empires form the kind of political backbone of both of these things. It provides the sort of overarching structure for the British to be in the Middle East and either actively ruling some of these petrostates or you know, doing it somewhat indirectly, but still, you know, pulling the strings behind the throne. And then sort of crucially, after World War II, we get to a decolonization period, meaning that the Western European countries that have had all these colonies, far-flung colonies around the world, they start to lose control of them. And that has really significant consequences for a lot of things, but including the oil production subsystem, right? The two subsystems come apart. And in particular, it gets much harder for, you know, countries that are in what we now call the global north to select the leaders of countries or polities in the global south, right? That they used to have them as colonies and they could just install somebody as a regent or a king or a, you know, a viceroy or whatever it is. And now they can't do that. They also used to be able to be quite happy to sort of assassinate people or remove them from the throne. And we still see some of that, but it's a lot rarer, right? And even for non-colonial powers like the United States, it still happens, but it's a lot rarer. And so, yes, we can point to some cases where the US has tried to do that, but it's much, much rarer and much harder. It's not seen as legitimate statecraft anymore to go around shooting heads of state in the global south. And so that means that the instruments of coercion that the Anglo-American powers have to hold this system of oil production together have suddenly eroded at the bottom, right? So now they don't have the sort of stick of being able to say, you will do what we say or we will remove you from power. And without that stick, then the only thing that keeps the oil system going in the 50s and 60s for a while is that there's some economic benefits and there's too much oil in the world, right? There's so much supply that the colonies, the petrostates that are producing this oil think, okay, we're just going to play ball. They can't see a way to effectively transition. But in the 70s, you get a real shift, right? And this is where we're going with the, in the early 1970s, the global market for oil tightens up because demand has caught up. The adaptation of the car worldwide has just risen so fast that now there's a huge demand for oil and there's not enough supply. And the members of OPEC say, aha, our moment has arrived. Now we're going to nationalize, and there's nothing that the Anglo-American companies can do about it. And so what was this cartel of seven Anglo-American companies known as the Seven Sisters, we call them now, you know, Exxon Mobil and Chevron and BP and Shell. Those were back then seven companies that really controlled the world market for oil. They were disrupted in the 1970s and told more or less to go home and that it would be the national oil companies like Saudi Aramco and PDVSA in Venezuela and the Iranian National Oil Company that would be the big producers and the big economic beneficiaries of their oil sector. And so that's where you get this huge shift in 1973, which causes the 73 oil crisis.
Something that I found so fascinating was how what happened in 1973, the sort of run up to this was 20 years in the making. You talk about what you describe as a transnational group of anti-colonial elites. And it's a group of several men, leadership of various countries like Venezuela, Iran, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, Libya, Egypt, Brazil, so on and so forth. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about these people, what the work that they did and the sort of thinking that they had as a reaction to the Seven Sisters and this kind of groundwork that they laid for OPEC.
Yes. And so you do have this group of anti-colonial elites in lots of countries in the global south. But the ones who are in petrostates are, in some sense, the most successful because what they're looking for is economic, and what in their own words, an economic sequel to decolonization. They want control of their own economies because right now they feel like, okay, we got political independence, but we're still tied to these economic masters who are in, you know, in the global north. You have kind of idealists in Venezuela and Saudi Arabia, these two men, Perez Alfonso and Abdullah Tariki is the guy in Saudi Arabia. They get together and what they want is to make OPEC a cartel that's equivalent to the Texas Railroad Commission, which is what their original inspiration comes from, an American idea, right? So it's funny now in the 21st century, we hear all these American politicians calling OPEC, you know, this sort of anti-American, horrible institution. Well, guess what? They got the idea from the Texas Railroad Commission as an organization that could control the price of oil and allow them to extract the most rents that they possibly could. And so they worked together in, and they found OPEC in 1960, but at the time, you know, the idea of how OPEC could work together, it's the market conditions aren't there for them to work. And so the original founders, Tariki and Alfonso, get discouraged and sort of give up on OPEC a couple of years later. But what they don't know is that they've succeeded, and the real success isn't going to show until the 1970s, when the market conditions change and allow OPEC members to nationalize the oil sectors and, you know, raise the price of oil.
Why is it that you focus on this event, and why in your mind is this oil crisis so crucial for how you are rethinking international relations theory?
Yeah, so part of it is when we think about international order, we often reach back to moments like, you know, Athens versus Sparta in Thucydides' world, right? Or the loss of British hegemony, like what did that mean for international order? And so American theorists who are confronted with this idea of a rising China and a declining or relative decline of the US reach for those kinds of analogies. And my point is to say, actually, you know, we can learn something from those analogies, but they're pretty strained analogies, right? A lot has changed since ancient Athens. And so we might do better by looking to our own country just a few decades ago, experiencing relative decline in the 1970s and the loss of, you know, some instruments of power in a particular issue area, namely oil, and think about how that might affect other issue areas in the 21st century. And so the point, coming back to where we started about hegemony and the sort of the theories of change of international order, is to say, actually, instead of one hegemon that is fully in control of everything, right, and has like dominance in all possible areas of international relations, whether it's the biggest economy or the strongest military or control over all capital flows and natural resource flows, instead, we should think about, in the real world, a hegemon is likely to be partially in control, right? That it has, you know, dominance in some, but not all of those areas. And so in the 21st century, we might imagine that right now the US is, you know, in charge, it still has the largest and most powerful military, but it is losing control of other issue areas. And you can see how China is surging ahead in some specific areas and not others. And so to understand what the political dynamics of that looks like, why don't we look back to the 1970s and see exactly where this happened before in a different issue, in oil, and try to learn what that tells us for the 21st century. And the basic lessons here is that the durable agreements that form international order, they endure under some conditions and they collapse under others. And so we need to learn what those conditions are so that we know what to expect in the 21st century.
Another thing that you talk about that's obviously, you know, tightly related to this is this notion of oil for security. Maybe I you know was sort of misinterpreting what some of part of your argument is, but you know I thought it was interesting that you were seemed to be implying that or seemed to be arguing that the rising presence of U.S. military was not an example of like increasing U.S. power and hegemony, but was actually like a almost coming out of a weakness of the fact that the U.S. didn't have access to oil in the same way. So, you know, sometimes when we think, oh, the U.S. military is everywhere, they must be more powerful, that almost in a sense, the U.S. Army military having greater presence in other places is a sign of weakness. Does that make sense? Or is that what you're kind of arguing?
So in a sense, but I would put it a little differently. I would say that in the period from 1945 to about 70, what the US was able to do was delegate. They essentially allowed Britain, not allowed, Britain had already been the sort of regional hegemon in the Middle East and wanted to continue doing it until they found that they just couldn't anymore. They kind of couldn't afford it and couldn't keep it up. And so the United States was really quite happy with that arrangement and so stayed out of the Middle East to not to an absolute degree, but to a large degree. They were happy with the British sort of paying the costs of providing military security to the Persian Gulf region until, you know, sort of famously in 1968, the British announced, you know, we're leaving. And 3 years later, in 1971, they did leave, right? The military left, the British military left. And that created something of a power vacuum in the 1970s, up to the point where you get in 1979, the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan. And for that, that was a real kind of wake-up moment for the US national security apparatus, because there was real concern that it might go farther, right? The Soviet Union might think about, well, maybe we could get a stranglehold on the whole oil producing region that is the foundation for the US led West. And so the Carter Doctrine that Jimmy Carter announced was, look, we more or less, I'm paraphrasing here, is that we will regard any attack by the Soviet Union or anyone else on countries in the Persian Gulf as an attack on the vital interests of the United States of America. And by implication, we will respond with force, right? This is our turf, is what we were declaring there. And then the military presence from then on, as you say, has gone upwards rather than downwards. Of course, some of that is really regrettable. I think like a lot of other people, I very much regret the U.S. decision to go to war in Iraq in 2003. I think that was a disastrous decision. So it was not all good, but I'm not saying that by any means, but it comes out of this idea that the U.S. would provide security for an oil providing region. And over time, what's ironic actually is that it's not really the U.S. that needed the oil from the Persian Gulf all that much. The U.S. was getting most of its oil throughout this period from either its own production or from Western Hemisphere producers like Canada, Venezuela, Mexico. But they were getting some. The U.S. is still getting or was getting some Persian Gulf oil, but its allies, right? So U.S. allies in Europe and Japan in particular were dependent on Persian Gulf oil. And so the U.S. understood that it needed to provide military production to Persian Gulf so that the economies of Europe and Japan didn't fall apart on some level.
When it comes to oil today, people obviously are always interested in this question of climate change. And you focus a lot on the issue of climate change in the end of your book. So I was wondering if you could talk about that and the sort of way in which you take subsystems theory and apply it to this challenge.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So I too am very worried about climate change. I mean, the first thing that has to be said about oil is that I think even though I am a huge climate hawk and I want us to act as aggressively as we can to avoid the worst outcomes of climate change, the reality is that we are too hooked on oil to get off of it in the near term. that even if we were selling a lot more electric vehicles than we are today, the rate of turnover of our capital that is dependent on oil, like say car fleets, we don't buy new cars every year, we buy them once every 10 or 15 years. And so even if we were selling 100% new cars were electric vehicles, it would still take, you know, a decade or more to change over our transportation fleet to a non-oil source. And by the way, we are nowhere close to selling all cars, all new cars as electric vehicles, right? So this is going to take decades. And the point here is to think of oil as declining over a period of, you know, 30 to 40 or 50 years, maybe 60 years. That's comes out of the sort of economics of oil and energy. The environmental imperative, of course, is to get off of oil much faster than that. The implication that we'll still be consuming significant amounts of oil 60 years from now are terrifying. And so there's a real tension here, and that is true. So I guess the first point is to say, look, oil politics is going to be a big part of our future, even in an age of significant climate change. Having said that, I do think that the subsystems theory that I develop around how international order works can tell us something about what we need to make international order over climate change work. We can see when governing arrangements in oil have endured. They've typically endured when those arrangements provide benefits to the people that are participating in them, and when there's someone powerful who can wield a stick to apply punishments when people aren't complying with the order as it's set up. Those are the kind of two key variables. And in the way we're thinking about climate change right now, say with the Paris Agreement, unfortunately, we don't meet those conditions very well. The Paris Agreement really doesn't have an enforcement mechanism at all. And so we have a very weak form of international order. And we need to be thinking about setting up additional kinds of governing arrangements that are going to have real teeth to them, as opposed to just making the Paris Agreement our one big hope and that it will solve everything. I just don't think it will. I'm not saying that the Paris Agreement is useless. I think it's worth doing, and it provides some good benefits in terms of ratcheting up norms and goals and sharing some lessons on all of these sort of soft things that are helpful in international politics. But we also need some agreements that have some real teeth to them. And to my mind, the two areas that have the biggest potential for generating agreements that have real teeth on to them are the trade system and the finance area, right? So that we can get pro-climate policy in trade and pro-climate policy in finance. And so just very briefly, what I mean by that in the trade area is I'm talking about potentially carbon tariffs, so that countries that are leaders, like Europe right now is leader on the climate change area, are understandably moving towards wanting to have a carbon border adjustment mechanism. This is a proposal at the EU right now, which are, in essence, those are carbon tariffs. A carbon border adjustment mechanism says that, you know, if we're going to be importing steel or glass or, you know, other kind of dirty, high polluting products from areas outside of the EU, like Turkey or Russia or, you know, India, then those products are going to have to pay a tariff that is equivalent to the environmental costs that producers inside the EU face, because that's the only way the EU producers will clean up their act, right? The whole idea of getting the EU steel manufacturers to be, you know, low carbon steel production, that's going to be costly. That's going to raise their manufacturing costs. And they won't do it if that puts them at a competitive disadvantage to a bunch of producers in the dirty parts of the world that aren't abiding by this. And so the only way to make that work really is to create carbon tariffs to allow that kind of thing to happen, right? So that's where you start to see agreements that have real teeth. And ideally what we want is not just for the EU to have carbon tariffs, but for there to be some sort of multilateral system so that the countries that are the climate leaders, and I hope the US will join that club, will have carbon tariffs to distinguish them from and to protect them against the countries that are climate laggards, that are not cleaning up their manufacturing sectors. I've said enough there. So there's lots more to say, but I'll say enough.
You also mentioned finance, and I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit to that as well, how you see the finance sector as participating in this.
Yeah, that's much harder. And I think actually many smart people are working on that. And I think we are, as a group, as a planet, we are less far along in what our thinking is. But I think ultimately what we want to do is to provide, first of all, kind of standards and incentives for corporations to report how much emissions they're making, to impose some costs, right? So that we want to impose a cost of capital on projects that are going to be heavily polluting, and reduce the cost of capital for greener projects, right? And there's lots of different ways of imagining that we might do that, whether that's sort of through ESG mechanisms or through central bank actions or, you know, different kinds of premiums, borrowing premiums or lending capital requirements that we might tweak. But the basic idea is to change the actual cost of capital for green projects versus not green projects, and so that we can favor the ones that will help us move towards a decarbonized global economy. And the urgency with which we must do that, I feel on an almost daily basis that, I mean, look, if we don't do this, if we get this wrong, we are going to face really catastrophic consequences 30 or 40 years down the road. And to make the change, we have to start now. We can't, you know, push this any farther along as we've been doing, sort of kicking the can down the road and not grappling with the problem.
Something I always like to ask is, you know, if there's anything that's happened, any recent events. Obviously, there's been a lot of recent events, any responses to what you've written that have either confirmed some of, in your view, confirmed some of the things that you wrote or made you rethink some of your conclusions.
Yeah, so one thing that I've been asked a lot about is the war in Ukraine recently. And to my mind, part of it is a great illustration of what I mean by punishments for noncompliance, right? So again, when I think about why does international order change, there's two things that matter. One is the benefits of the order and how big are the benefits to the people that are participating in the order. And the second one is punishments for noncompliance. Like, is there somebody who's willing and able to kind of wield a stick punish people who are not complying with the governing arrangements? And I see the actions by the United States and Europe with regard to sanctions on Russia for its invasion in Ukraine as a great illustration of what punishments for noncompliance really looks like in practice, right? So the order in this case is the UN, you know, Article 1 or 2, whatever it is, that says countries will not go to war for territorial gain anymore. And then Russia violates that order, goes into a war of conquest over Ukraine. The West says, no, you will not do that, and we will punish you for it. Now, it gets tricky because Russia is not just any country. This is the country with the largest nuclear arsenal on the planet. And so punishments have to, you know, fit the situation. It's not like the U.S. can just push back as they did, say, in 1990 when Iraq didn't comply with the international order. In that case, the US organized a military coalition and fought the Iraqis back, right? In the situation with Ukraine, it's economic tools because we're trying to avoid World War III. Of course, that story doesn't have an ending yet, so we'll see how it all plays out. But that part of it, I think, is really important. And there, what's interesting, I guess, is that even though I've emphasized in the book about how subsystems have this kind of quasi-independence from each other, right, where sometimes one can change and the other one not change at the same time, in this case, where you get, you know, a big shift in the territorial sovereignty subsystem around Ukraine, it has ripple effects into other subsystems. And so in particular, in the energy, European energy scene, we're seeing, you know, a ban on Russian coal, a proposed ban on Russian oil, and potentially, you know, something in natural gas as well, although it's not clear sort of who will be the initiator and the person who suffers the most pain from any kind of cutoff of natural gas from Russia to Europe. So subsystems do interact, and they sometimes, you know, a shock in one of them has ripple effects into the others.
So Jeff, before we wrap this up, the last question I'd like to ask is if you're working on anything new, anything related to this or something completely different?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I am working on something that's sort of an extension to the book and thinking about how these oil for security arrangements that the US has with the Persian Gulf, how those might change in an age of climate change, right? And so if we're serious about getting off of oil, and as I've said, that's a process that will take quite a long time, but even if it takes decades, the fact that we are anticipating now that we might get off of oil, that kind of undermines the whole idea of an oil for security arrangement. With the time horizon of like, okay, this might end in a couple of decades, actors already now are starting to think about, well, what does this mean for geopolitics? And so there's some indication that, you know, the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates are starting to think about, you know, should we be getting a shift of political alignment to some other great power that can protect us, like China, or should we develop our own military capacity? And we're seeing some signs of that as well in Saudi Arabia. And so it's not clear how this is going to play out, but that's part of what I'm working on, is trying to learn from the history of those oil for security arrangements. If we want to understand how climate change is going to affect geopolitics, we should start by understanding how fossil fuels have already affected geopolitics, and therefore getting rid of those fossil fuels, you know, might unwind those consequences. So that's what I'm working on.
That sounds equally interesting. And, you know, when you produce something, we'd love to have you on again. Well, thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Caleb. It's great talking with you. I really appreciate the opportunity.